As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
I'm sorry, you can sit there and look and play with all your silly machines as much as you like.
Is Gascoigne going to have a crack? He is, you know. Oh, I say!
And tame, and tame again.
Crank up the music! Charge your glass! This nation is going to dance all night!
Tildesley and McCoist's five-goal thriller, Barry from EastEnders, expected chuckles with David Seaman, Romelu Lukaku and the language of goals, a Wembley pitch-flavoured beer, Karen Carney's pitch-side thermometer, and the future mid-table Premier League stars of Euro 2020. Brought to your ears by The Athletic, this is Football Clichés. Right now you can subscribe to The Athletic for a special price of £1 a month for 6 months. You'll enjoy great analysis and in-depth features from the very best football writers around, as well as ad-free versions of all of our podcasts. So go to theathletic.com/clichéspod to take advantage of this special discount. That's theathletic.com/clichéspod. Hello everyone, welcome to episode 74 of the Football Clichés podcast. I'm Adam Hurry, and with me to take a look at some very unimportant things from the first few days of Euro 2020 are, first of all, Dave Walker. How are you doing?
I am very good. As I sat down to record this, I've just looked to my right where my wall chart is, and I've noticed that I filled yesterday's games in last night when I came in after a full day in the pub, but I've done it really sloppily, like outside the lines, Can't even really tell what the score was in one of the matches. Apart from that, I'm fine, but I'm annoyed about that.
Well, as a wall chart atheist, I'm not an atheist. I believe that they exist. Sorry. As a wall chart agnostic, maybe I'm agnostic. I don't do wall charts, is what I'm trying to say. Can't you just buy a new one? Is that sacrilege?
Not buy a new one.
Why not?
What do you mean? It is sacrilege. Yeah, I've started that. It is a holy, sacred document.
Hmm. All charts are an express version of fantasy football. They require too much discipline and I give up very quickly. Anyway, alongside you, James Moore, how are you doing tonight?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you, Adam. Yeah, wall charts were the bane of my existence for quite a few years in my previous job, so just the mere mention of them kind of brings me up in a cold sweat, so can we just move on quickly, please?
No, I want to follow up on that.
But designing these things is incredibly irritating.
Well, this is it.
And also, they're really expensive to make. They actually cost quite a lot of money to print. So to put that on top of the cost of printing a magazine, they're actually quite a big markup. So, I mean, it's all very boring, but basically you need like a sponsor to pay for it. And if you don't get one, readers of premium football magazines will kick off. I'll tell you that from experience.
Does it matter if it's landscape or portrait or a lot, surely, we found out last week, circular?
I mean, that circular thing is insane. I mean, respect to the times for trying something new, but I mean, I just can't. I can't fathom that. That must have been a waste of paper, circular, right? Surely.
Yeah.
No, mine's not circular. If it was, the state I was in last night, I probably would have fallen over trying to complete it, I think.
The first true lad moment of the Football Cliché podcast. A man trying to fill in his war chart for the Euros while pissed. Anyway, tonight, or last night, listeners, Dave, we were treated to the five-goal thriller of Holland 3, Ukraine 2, which was very much the Holland 2, Czech Republic 3, Euro 2004 of proceedings. The tournament really kind of getting on its feet.
Yeah.
Is it any coincidence to you that it was Ally McCoist and Clyde Tilsley on the mic?
That made it all the more enjoyable. I mean, yes, you know, even if it was a dull 0-0, they would have, you know, made it at least bearable. But it was great. They were both having fun. And it was just a really fun tournament match. Like, it's just one of those games where you don't really care about either team involved. Holland, they're quite fun. Ukraine are surprisingly fun. Not the boring Ukraine of old, and a very enjoyable experience for a Sunday evening.
James, I mean, last week we talked about Clive Tilsley's kind of floating role in this tournament and how he might thrive without the pressure of England on his shoulders. He seemed to quite enjoy himself for this one.
He and Ali really did enjoy themselves, and that was at odds with what was happening in the studio, particularly at full time. I mean, you'd expect Nigel de Jong to be kind of, you know, a bit tense given the Dutch blew a two-goal lead, and even though they did eventually win the game. But Roy Keane was absolutely livid. I mean, it's such a weird, like, sort of yin and yang of pundits, that, isn't it? Roy Keane and Ally McCoist. Mm. Like, they like belong in different universes, really. They should be talking about different football matches. You talked last week about Ally McCoist being in his element at, like, some sort of end-of-season game between Wolves and Southampton, where there's not a lot on the line and he can just kind of express himself, have a bit of fun with it. But, yeah, Roy Keane is always just so intense. And I can't work out why he's so annoyed that Holland only won the game 3-2. I mean, he's absolutely furious that this kind of small nation who have punched above their weight for years are no longer completely dominant in European football. I mean, maybe he's projecting there, possibly. I don't know. But it
sounds like he'd been bottling that up for quite a while. Then,
yeah.
But
I mean, well, Ireland didn't qualify, did they? So maybe there's maybe there's some kind of projection there. But yeah, it was really strange to see him. Like, everyone's had a really great evening watching this game. You know, you kind of go back to the studio and you think, right, let's watch the goals and kind of, you know, analyse all of this. And there's some really nice goals there. The Yarmolenko one was brilliant. But yeah, Roy Keane just kind of straight in there with the really sort of negative comments about the defending. It was sort of like, it was like Alan Hansen at his worst, really. It's kind of, sort of, it just, that wasn't the kind of party vibes that I was looking for.
I wonder if he's doing the punditry equivalent of backing himself into kind of like a, he's doing the colour piece for a game for a newspaper, and he's got to suddenly think of an idea. So in Keane's world, he's got to think of something to get angry about, and he's just really scraping the barrel. But I don't know, it's nice to have someone cast out over everyone else's fun. Stephen Cook writes in and says, Dave, there were three I tell yous from Ali within the first 3 minutes and 42 seconds. So he hit the ground running, clearly.
Yes, and unless I missed this and sort of as I was kind of drifting, my attention was drifting away during the quiet moments of the game, I don't think he gave us any trivia about Holland, you know, like he was doing in the World Cup. Mm. He was doing, this Russian city used to be or whatever, you know, in the war and stuff. Which I like because I was worried, you know, we don't want him to lapse into caricature, as we've just been talking about Roy Keane.
No,
it's fine. You don't need it, Ali. Yeah.
He's scuppered by the pan-European Euros. I mean, where does he do his research?
All the cities are too well known.
Exactly. Just read the top line of the Wikipedia page. Anyway, actually, this was via you, Dave, in fact. I think, this tournament is only a fledgling affair, but I wonder if this may well be the defining sound of Euro 2020. I'm not going to dress it up. This is Barry from EastEnders singing at Box Park Croydon before kickoff on Friday night. I think you better slow down or stay down. Go on, I can. James, what could get you more in the mood for the Euros than Barry from EastEnders singing Mustang Sally?
I mean, what is the thinking there? People paid for that. I mean,
Beyond parody situation, Dave? What happened?
I don't think people would necessarily have paid to go there, but obviously they have chosen to go there to have a good time and enjoy themselves and presumably spend a reasonable amount of money whilst there. And it just so happens that Barry from EastEnders is there. He was there again today ahead of the England game. I saw someone I know on Instagram earlier recording it on their stories, and he was doing Sweet Caroline. A rousing rendition of Sweet Caroline. I think he's only got, you know, he's only got a few songs in his repertoire.
I was about to say
Mustang Sally, Sweet Caroline, of course. The
Something Inside So Strong is presumably so strong. That's his Ness and Dorma, isn't it?
Yeah.
he'll do that before the final.
Yeah, absolutely.
If he makes it that far. Surreal scenes.
Someone during lockdown, someone I know, his girlfriend got Barry from EastEnders to do a cameo for him for his birthday.
Yes.
A cameo message, quite a long message. It was like nearly like 4 or 5 minutes long. He sung the whole rendition of Something Inside So Strong. He also did like a sort of tight 2 minute sort of stand-up-y bit that he's obviously done a million times before. And you know, in the cameo thing, you have to sort of give them a few pointers to go off. And obviously it had been mentioned that this guy, Sam, was an Arsenal fan. So he went, "Sam, I hear you're an Arsenal fan. I'm a Fulham fan myself, but recently I've been following a new team, Lion King FC. They've been doing okay. They started off with a win away, a win away, then a win away, a win away, a win away, a win away." And
That's a good joke. A good joke. On a technical level, that's a very good joke. Yeah, it is. It is. It is. It works really well. I like the rhythm of it. I don't think you would see that coming. I mean, I don't think you would see the punchline coming. I do.
No offense, but delivered by Barry from EastEnders, that actually would be quite a lot more fun.
Of course, yeah. No, his delivery far better than mine. Do you think the crucial question is? Do you think he did it on stage at the Croydon Box Park as part of his act?
100%.
Moving swiftly on, Charlie Eccleshare warned us about this before the tournament, James, and lo and behold, before the tournament even begun, we had punditry homework banter on the BBC. Cue clip.
And then in a group with North Macedonia, who you know a lot about, obviously, Mike.
I knew you'd do that. I've got my stuff back if you need them.
Don't worry. I won't do that to you.
Quite an extreme version of the genre, James. I mean, that film was almost mocking to North Macedonia.
Yeah, I mean... It does seem weird that they're so keen to highlight their... I thought we'd kind of move past this sort of stage of pundits being kind of willfully ignorant. And I mean, I guess, you know, a tournament like this, there are probably half a dozen teams that most people will know next to nothing about, which is fair enough. But I feel like they've done that specifically to tee up for Micah Richards to laugh right, to get the first one in.
Yes, to get the first one
into the tournament.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what the licence fee players want, right, from Micah Richards and the BBC. That's what he's there for.
You could say any joke. Barry from EastEnders' shit joke would go down a storm with Micah Richards, and it would make it funny. His laugh does make even the worst, most boring gags a bit funnier.
Speaking of laughter, stumbled across a hit new podcast this week. It's called Seaman Says. David Seaman, Dave, has his own podcast.
Now you've said that out loud, I've only just
got it. Yeah, I've just got it as well, yeah.
He has his own podcast. He sort of ruminates on the art of goalkeeping and reminisces on what it's like to be an England player. It's quite a jovial affair, Dave. So he interviewed Gazza and Yuri Geller. So there were laughs aplenty. But my question to you is, I spent this evening listening to the entire episode on 3x speed to find out how many times David Seaman chuckles during episode 1 of his podcast. Now, if anyone's wondering about the technicalities of this, I'm talking about individual chuckles. He may chuckle several times at the same thing, but I'm measuring the individual distinct chuckles.
So,
if he talks in between chuckles, then that's two chuckles.
But what if he, when you say individual chuckles, if he was like going, is that like four?
Oh, no, that's the same chuckle. That's one continuous laugh. Okay. Is a chuckle. If he stops and does something else, either pauses or says something, or someone interrupts and then he laughs again, that would be separate chuckles. So the undulations are not individual chuckles, I should add.
Okay.
I didn't think that needed explaining. That's a weird thing to have to explain. Don't you know what a chuckle is? Is that how you laugh?
The way you explained it, that's what I thought you were going to do.
Anyway, it was a 50-minute episode, Dave. I want you to guess how many times David Seaman chuckled in 50 minutes.
50 minutes... Is he going to have more than one chuckle per minute? I think so. I'm going to say... I'm going to say... 106 chuckles.
106 chuckles.
I'm going to go north.
Is that ludicrously high?
I'm going higher.
I don't know. It's
higher.
Very precise, though.
I reckon.
You're going higher, right?
So 50 minutes, did you say?
Yes,
I'm going to say
minutes.
On average 2.5 a minute. So it was 125.
125. Yeah. 125 chuckles in a single podcast episode. He does laugh a lot. That is his thing. I can tell you that James was the closest, but he wasn't quite there. It was 131 chuckles.
Wow.
Surprisingly easy to figure that out on 3x speed because his chuckles still actually resonate. So this is one chuckle every 23 seconds.
Quite disappointed that you haven't taken the time to just make a montage of all the chuckles with everything else cut out.
I was listening to that literally half an hour before we recorded this. It would have been way beyond the call of duty to perform that editorial function. But one every 23 seconds, joviality personified, and one chuckle every 23 seconds. So if you want a podcast where someone chuckles 131 times, you know where to go. Highly, well, moderately recommended by me. Moving on, this, Dave, is my highlight of the tournament so far. I'm sure others would share this with me. This is Romelu Lukaku making it 3-0 for Belgium against Russia on Saturday night. And, let's just listen to the commentary, shall we?
59% of his players speak Dutch or Flemish, 40% French, a small fraction German. Here's Lukaku. He speaks the language of goals and he feeds off them.
That's lovely.
I don't want to say it's Partridge. I want to treat it at face value. Dave, what is the language of goals? How long does it take to become fluent in the language of goals?
I think the language of goals would be Spanish or Portuguese, isn't it? If you have to pick one.
Okay. So you don't think it's your own distinct language like Esperanto or something like that?
Maybe. I hadn't given it much thought, but
I think that was actually episode 3 of this podcast. If we deign to look backwards, I'm sure we did a whole episode on this. But so maybe Romelu Lukaku has been sat there listening to it on 3x speed. I like to think so. James,
right?
As you say, effortless, very smooth from Mataface there, wasn't it?
Yeah.
On ITV.
I mean, that must be a great feeling as a commentator, when it just kind of flows exactly like that. Like you can see the chance presenting itself. You know, there's an opportunity for a great line. I mean, that is, I guess, the kind of commentary equivalent of a tap-in, really, isn't it, I suppose?
Yeah.
But you've got to get into the position, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I don't want him to make a habit of that, Dave. I mean, we had the Melon Sue incident at the Women's World Cup.
I mean, no, I think we know by now that Sam's obviously got that in his locker, and I don't think he minds. I think, he's very aware that, these clips have gone around in the past and stuff, and it's sort of like similar to what you said about Ali McCoist earlier. As long as you just tread that fine line of not going to the well too often and not being too on the nose, not being too Partridge, I think you can get away with it.
Absolutely. On the eve of England's opening game, James, I received an email, possibly the first PR email I've opened and read from top to bottom for a very, very long time. And it alerted me to the fact that a new beer has been brewed, Wembeerly IPA, and it's made using the exact same ryegrass seeds as the hallowed turf at Wembley, making it the first beer in the world to be made from a football pitch. Promising
not,
already?
Not
yeah,
really,
I'm,
though,
I'm
is
not
it?
Convinced, but go on.
I reckon if you drink enough of it, you could still fill in your wall chart. superbly well. More details here, Dave. The beer is brewed using the exact same blend of rare rye seeds that grow into the pitch at Wembley. It's been developed by Block 109, a supporters group set up to improve the atmosphere at Wembley. And some of the proceeds are going to be going to grassroots football, so that's a nice touch as well. But all I'm interested in is what the hell a beer brewed from the same grass as Wembley could potentially taste like. What kind of mouthfeel does it conjure in your mind straight away?
Well, I'll tell you what it tastes like. The same as every other fucking craft beer that there is.
No.
They all taste the same. That's one thing I've learned in this last year in lockdown, having signed up to Beer 52 and been too afraid to cancel with the man on the phone since, that they all taste the same. And they're nice. It's not a criticism of them, but like no matter what the marketing guff is on the side of the can, no matter where the seeds or the wheat or whatever's come from, I couldn't tell you the difference. Unless it's like actual flavours, like a pineapple beer or something.
I just want to take a moment to reflect on the potential nationwide plight of podcast producers who have been sucked into subscription offers from people who advertise on their podcasts. It's sort of subliminally entering your brain until you subscribed. God knows when your Manscaped product is going to turn up.
Stitch Fix, it's all still coming through the door.
You must be LinkedIn pro by now, I guess. James, we asked our listeners what they thought when beerly IPA would taste like. Sam says the beer will taste of Umbro, if it even has a taste. Yeah, I can kind of, yeah, sort of slightly musty, but also of reasonable quality.
Yeah, my experience of Wembley is always, it all kind of feels quite sort of synthetic, even though the pitch I don't think is, I mean, they're all sort of hybrid pitches now, aren't they? But everything else at Wembley just feels so sort of big and plastic. I can't imagine this thing tasting like anything other than sort of really cheap and nasty, plasticky, just horribleness.
There is nothing that tastes nice in within a mile radius of Wembley.
I don't think you're taking this quite in the spirit that it was intended. I mean, let's think of the famous things about Wembley. I mean,
you think it tastes like a horse?
Not a huge pint drinker myself. I reckon I'd struggle to get to the end of a pint of Wembley. I'd really start flagging towards the final 10 minutes as my my stomach begins to fatigue. Rubbish chat. What am I talking about?
All I can think of is the Simon, pitch used to be rubbish. Then the pitch was like too wet or something. I
mean, energy sapping. Energy sipping. Simon Ben Nathan says, when beerly IPA would be obscured by an annoying permanent shadow on one edge and served at an angle that's unnaturally close to pitch level. He's Simon Ben Nathan there, James, really tapping into a widespread frustration with Sunday's England games. We couldn't watch it because the shadow was on the pitch. Whose fault is this? God? Wembley or the BBC?
I mean, it's certainly not the BBC's fault, even though quite a few people on Twitter... Both. Well, seemingly a lot of people on Twitter thought it was specifically the BBC's fault.
That's sensational.
To be perfectly honest, watching it at Athletic HQ this afternoon with no blinds, it did actually make it a bit of an ordeal for me. But yeah, that is definitely an issue at Wembley, isn't it? I mean, I think, you know, given most of the big matches there are played kind of in the summer months, you would have thought they'd kind of find a resolution to that one way or another.
If only we had one of the one of those big metal clouds from the Qatar World Cup, we'd be fine.
Well, I mean, UEFA and FIFA as well, they seem quite an image-obsessed thing. And some of the finer details of a tournament are so nailed down, like the size of a logo or the continuity of colour on a kit in past tournaments and things like that, and advertising hoardings around the side. They're all very strictly controlled. I get the feeling that someone at UEFA thinks, this is not ideal for a TV audience. There's something that needs to be done. We're going to have indoor stadiums within the next 20 years purely for this reason, I swear.
It's funny you say that about the image of the tournament and stuff. There's something that doesn't sit right with me about seeing Wembley, like seeing, say, London over the tunnel or Wembley. It's like, it's not London, is it? It's Wembley.
Yeah.
I
don't think of it as London either, I have to say.
Yeah, so... I mean, it just doesn't look right. It doesn't feel right to me that this is the London Stadium. We literally have a stadium called the London Stadium, and it's not that one. And also, like they've moved they don't have the commentators all on the wrong side of the pitch and stuff. They've moved the normal commentary positions because it's UEFA.
That's UEFA's doing,
and it has to be in a certain place and a certain stands and everything. And it's just it is all a bit weird.
I
saw from our Athletic colleague Carl Anker today that they've switched all of the plug sockets in the commentary box and their press box to like European two-pin ones.
What?
So everyone's turned up with like their UK three-pin laptops, and they've had to get adapters.
That's unbelievable.
This is why we did Brexit.
Yes. Jesus Christ. That would just cost loads of money to do. Just get them all to bring adapters. What? That is classic UEFA. That's just nonsense bureaucracy and gone mad. Not this sort of podcast, is it really? Not that sort of podcast. But England-Croatia did happen, Dave. But you know, there was a kind of inevitable narrative, few narrative hurdles to overcome before we could see the game kick off. We came very, very close to another faux philosophical three lines debate before this match started. Do you have the energy for this again?
It doesn't matter. And I heard someone talking about this the other day, actually. It was a documentary about, it was Badil and Skinner. And it got me thinking, like, they don't, football's coming home doesn't necessarily mean that it's just coming to our home. It doesn't mean that it's necessarily the home of football.
No, I mean,
the football is coming here and we're at home.
Oh, okay, so you're approaching it from a technicality level. Whereas, James, there was a definite kind of, there's this kind of accusation of arrogance, but that reared its ugly head again this week with quotes from Luka Modric about England's kind of inherent arrogance. Although he said it wasn't the players, it was the journalists.
Wow.
Which is nice.
Yeah. I mean, it really did reek of the journalist part of the story. It really did reek of, and another thing, like he'd kind of had this bottled up for 3 years. I mean, he's clearly so rattled by it. I mean, it is a stupid song by two comedians that's 25 years old. And, you're right. I mean, I think the way people were using it as a kind of meme during the World Cup was quite different, and it was kind of faux pompous. But it was basically, even then, still a joke. And then England ended up getting to the semi-final, so it just became, like, it's kind of got completely out of control. But people were tweeting that, like, kind of, you know, when they were 6-0 up against Panama, people were tweeting, it's coming home. It was all kind of a bit of a joke. I just find it really weird that like, Croatia were, like, exposed to that, and then it just got completely wound up by it. I don't really understand how that was kind of in their consciousness, really, during the World Cup.
But also, I mean, with all due respect to Croatia, they're definitely not the home of football, are they? I mean, like, fair enough, if it's like China or Scotland or like one of the nations that maybe have a justifiable claim to being the birthplace of football, fine. Unless I'm unaware of the history of Croatia being the birthplace of football, then shut up, Luka Modric.
In fact, Three Lions Fever got to such a stage. Friend of the show, The Telegraph's Tom Gibbs, challenged me to try and find the original audio for the punditry at the start of Three Lions, which I thought would be an easy job. I couldn't find any of it. I feel like it's the YouTube holy grail. I got within a whisker, I thought, of finding it's bad news for the English game, because I had just assumed that it would be the punditry on the highlights after the game against Ireland was abandoned in 1995. And Alan Hansen talks for ages on Match of the Day about it, but he doesn't actually say those words. He got so close. So
that would have been quite a weird thing to have had in that montage.
But I mean, obviously, taken out of context, it works perfectly. But if anyone could find any of those three bits of punditry on YouTube, I'd be eternally grateful.
Yeah, we do need to conduct a nationwide search, I think. Calling all archivists out there to search what's going on.
I would happily do the long read on
so
that.
So it's Hansen, bad news for the English game. It's Jimmy Hill
saying go on getting bad results.
Brooking in there as well.
Brooking does their we're not positive enough.
Yeah. So it's could got to be surely. I mean, you know, it would have been relatively recent. You'd imagine before the recording of that song.
Yeah.
But maybe it was like a Graham Taylor, you know, post mortem going
93 to 95 is the window
the qualifying campaign. Not qualifying for the World Cup. The game against, who was it that we, the last game that we, against Holland, was it that we didn't get against
no,
the World
it,
Cup?
San Marino was the last game.
Yeah, so Holland was the decisive game. Mm. I mean, lots of people positing that it's bad news for the English game was England not qualifying for the World Cup, which I think was a little bit of an obvious thing to say, so it doesn't work. It's like, well, oh, it's bad news. Why is that, Alan? Well, I haven't qualified for the World Cup. So that's definitely not that. So
could it be something completely unrelated?
It could be the influx of
foreign players to the Premier League or something.
And Hansen did that documentary, The Football's Foreign Legion, didn't he? It's all coming together. Maybe it's from that documentary. Oh, maybe. We'll find out.
We'll try and find it by the time the tournament's over.
Yeah, that's definitely a long little project for us for the next month or so.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This perhaps fits in this medium-term running genre of football meets marketing, Dave. John Motson is doing the tube announcements at Wembley Park. What's his train obsession? We had train spotting John Motson on last episode, and now he's back again. How do you think he's delivering the bog standard information of where people are on the tube?
So is he doing like, this is Wembley Park, or is he doing like a bespoke like?
I think he'd be doing
hello,
it.
Hello, I'm John Motson. Good luck and enjoy the game at Wembley.
No, I think you're supposed to know it's him. I wouldn't put it past him to introduce himself when he's doing it, but I haven't heard it and I haven't heard any evidence of it. But James, I reckon he's probably doing it in that kind of faux incredulous tone that he uses for these sorts of gigs. He says, oh, it's Wembley Park.
This is a Jubilee line service to Stanmore.
I can only think there's some kind of joking tap in with your Oyster card. I mean, that kind of feels a bit too Route 1, but it is John Motson, so I wouldn't rule it out.
Dave, the preamble to the England game was dominated by montages. I worry we've peaked too soon with the montages. There were at least three montages on the BBC before the game kicked off, and they covered every possible avenue of English football history. We can go too big on montages, don't you think?
Definitely. I want a good, solid one at the start of the tournament, which I was disappointed with, actually, the first game.
Yes,
I was. Friday night, underwhelmed by that montage. But, you know, we're all obviously waiting for the big one at the end of the tournament, which will hopefully feature plenty of glorious reflections on amazing England performances.
I never watched that one because I never get that far. I never get to because they play it after the final. I'm switching off. One part of the montages before the England game, James, was a low key cover version of Heroes with sort of John Lewis level of song choice. I'd always back the BBC to do a montage for me, but I feel like they're looking rusty. Maybe that extra year off hasn't done them any good.
Yeah, you kind of want it to be a bit more rousing, don't you? You kind of want... I know you talked last week about the kind of classical music and whatever, but I just kind of feel like you need something that kind of captures the mood a bit more. And you're right, it was incredibly John Lewis. I mean, you're kind of expecting, like, you know, some old man sat on the moon looking through a telescope or whatever. I mean, it didn't quite...
Don't make it sound seedy.
But that was what happened in the advert. I mean, yeah, it just didn't capture the mood in the way that I think you kind of expected it might do. That was the advert, mate. You can't blame me. Right?
No, you're absolutely right. You've matter-of-factly explained what happened in the advert. The montage has set the tone, Dave, for what could potentially become a very, very cliched day of English football, because we had the montages. Then there was this talk about the starting lineup and where's Jack Grealish, and which is, of course, the official heralding of the start of what is known as the clamour for Jack Grealish, which will really kick in, I think, after the Scotland game. But we did win.
Well, that's it. For there to be a clamour, there needs to be something obviously going wrong with the performances. And I think Southgate very much silenced his critics today, didn't he? No one's talking about Kieran Trippier playing left back anymore.
Well, there
Calvin Phillips, too defensive. Calvin Phillips, no one's saying that anymore.
No, that's true. That's true. Okay, that's such an English thing. Why have we got two defensive midfielders? Why have we got, we're playing Croatia?
I literally had that exact message from a mate 1 minute past two or whatever the team news came out, 1 minute past one.
There is precedence for a post-win.
I nearly sent them the Emma Hayes article from The Athletic, where she explained that very precise point about why they should have two defensive midfielders. But I just thought, I mean, with apologies to my employers, I thought, I just can't be bothered. He's not going to read it.
Can't be bothered. That's our marketing
just
strategy.
Just let him be angry.
The best team of football writers ever assembled, if you can be asked. James, there is a precedent for a post-win clamour. If you look back to World Cup 98, we beat Tunisia 2-0, there was still a clamour for Michael Owen when we struggled. We struggled against Romania in the second game.
Sorry, I thought the clamour in 98 was for David Beckham, wasn't it?
Maybe there was a double clamour.
I mean, that is...
I think so.
What a fantastic combination of players for there to be a clamour for as well, by the way.
I agree. I mean, Michael Owen is pure clamour.
The teenage prodigy is definitely pace. The one. Yeah, you're right. He's exciting. You know, he's got pace is the kind of thing that you want. That's the thing that kind of mediocre English teams always feel like they're missing. And it's not loads of pace in this team, actually.
With Beckham, though, I think another aspect of clamour is set-piece delivery.
That's true.
Yes.
Which we've seen with James Ward-Prowse recently. Yeah. Mm. Trent Alexander-Arnold and all that. So
it's just a sense of having
boxes ticked.
It's just a sense of having a gimmick, isn't it? That no other player in that, be it like kind of searing pace or like set piece delivery.
You wouldn't clamour for a big man. You wouldn't clamour for a sort of piece.
No, there was definitely. I'm sure there have been moments where there's been clamour for a big man. Definitely,
there would be calls for Peter Crouch, but I don't think you earn a clamour just by being tall. I think this is important.
You're right. As always, Adam, you're right.
Fair enough. But the England-related cliches didn't stop there, but I want to question this next one. It was a very hot day at Wembley, Dave, as you may have spotted. And I started to wonder, sort of midway through the first half, as England's bright start began to fade, that they would wilt in the heat. And wilt is the only word you're allowed to use in this scenario. And then I thought, well, this is a perfectly feasible scenario. England's high energy style at the end of a long season is really going to work against them in these high temperatures. But does it work if it's your heat? If it's English heat? I mean, Mexico 86, yeah, sure. But can you wilt in your own heat? That seems wrong to me.
Yeah, no, I agree. You shouldn't. We shouldn't be wilting in your own heat. And like
English heat.
Yeah, it's the heat thing is ridiculous because I'm like, no one talked about how hot it was in Germany in 2006 in the World Cup, but it was very hot.
It's roasting.
Really hot. But it's Germany, so people sort of don't associate that with being a hot country. But it's same as here. Like we obviously get a lot of hot days. But and equally, South Africa was in the winter.
Yeah.
But everyone was going, oh, it's going to be really difficult down there in Johannesburg or wherever in that. Searing afternoon heat.
Yeah, people just don't think it gets hot in the London borough of Brent. But James, there are some iconographical thresholds that need to be met when it comes to football and heat, and we didn't get them, did we?
We didn't get the temperature pitch side during a game. Is that what you're alluding to?
Yeah, I don't think we have that. I don't think we've ever had that in an English game. Have we?
No, you get it at the cup final, don't you? Surely, you get it in the FA Cup.
In fact, we covered this on the podcast before, haven't we? The 1999 FA Cup final,
Richard Keys,
pitch side thermometer. Because Richard Keys was explaining Celsius to anyone who bothered to listen. No, but we didn't have a pitch side thermometer this time. But do you know what? I'm really going to get on my soapbox about this. Because, Dave, you know, there is this obsession with the temperature at pitch level. You know, that's different to the prevailing weather temperature. You know, it's much hotter down at pitch level. Don't measure it at pitch level. Measure it at 5'10" above pitch level. No one cares if your feet get hot. Your head gets hot.
Your whole body is hot. Don't you know anything?
I was listening to the radio commentary today because I was in a pub watching the game and they didn't have the commentary on loud enough. It was really annoying me to the point where I happily had the radio commentary 2 minutes behind in my ear just so it gave me something to listen to. I didn't mind it. And I heard Karen Carney on 5 Live, who was sort of in the pitch side reporter role in a different place to John Murray and the commentators, and she did mention the temperature. She said, oh, it's way above 30 degrees down here at pitch level. And I immediately thought, where has she got that information from?
Has she got an app on her phone?
Yeah. Is it just on the home screen on her phone? Is she just taking that as read?
It must be a PFA thing, like you get an access to a pitch side thermometer or something if you have a membership or something. I mean, obviously the hotter it gets at a major tournament, James, the higher the potential it is for a Jackie Charlton, John Aldridge style situation. I can't quite picture Southgate doing it. But if he did, which substitute is joining him?
We don't really have any angry lads, do we? Grealish, maybe Grealish?
Grealish, I can imagine. Frustration for not getting on, I suppose.
Connor Cody, I can imagine, gobbing off.
But he's not going to be...
Do you know what I mean? He's very nice.
Why does he need to come on, though? If
Connor Cody is coming... This isn't me criticising him as a player, but if England are putting Connor Cody on as a sub, it's probably like... You know, they're probably desperate for him to get on the pitch, right?
Yeah.
Well, no, absolutely not. You've got it completely wrong. If Connor Cody is going to come on for England, he's going to want to take as long as possible. It's going to be a slowing the game down sub in the last minute when we want to go up.
He might want to come on for a corner, say the last minute defending a corner. And then you might well indeed have this situation where he's turning to you away for official and saying, you twat, you dickhead. And I'd really like to see that, but hopefully the temperatures will remain at those levels purely for that reason.
Southgate's not going to wear an ill-fitting white baseball cap anytime soon, is he, either?
No, that's not Southgate, is it? Not at all. I don't know if
we're... You know, one of those Euro 96 bucket hats seems to be wearing now.
I don't know if we're far enough into the tournament to be discussing this, but it feels like an inevitable part of any major tournament, James. I'm starting to pick out players that look eerily like they might be polluting the Premier League in the next 18 months or so. I'm going to give you a couple of names from our listeners straight away. I can't give you any because I simply haven't been paying attention that much, but I'm going to start. Alex Hamon Otero says Dumfries to Everton for €25 million. Joe Martin follows up and says, I think I speak for everyone when I say Dumfries is 100% turning out for Everton at some point. Wow, well, you are indeed, Joe Martin. But Danny Porter counters that and says, maybe influenced by the current game I'm watching, but Dumfries could be Spurs' next option in the never-ending quest for a right-back that works. He's a little bit Spursy in Everton.
I can see that. That's the kind of club he'll join. He feels like a player who'd move to the Premier League and probably be quite good, kind of be sort of a steady sort of 6.57 out of 10 for like two seasons, but then lose his place to like an academy player from the club and then end up going back to Holland or wherever. Yeah, I can see that.
Newcastle as well.
I think I could see him there. Feels right.
Along the same lines, Dave, Paddy Milnes says Breel Embolo is nailed on for 23 appearances and 5 goals at some mid-table Premier League side next season.
Oh, West Ham.
And he follows that up by saying Everton, Spurs or Newcastle.
It's West Ham. West Ham will sign an average striker from this tournament.
Maybe Breel Embolo is quite West Ham-y.
They just love a striker, don't they? They just love a middling European striker that comes and goes and without, you know, much of an impact.
James, I was very fascinated by the range of replies I got to this because it was very narrow. And whilst I appreciate this is a kind of strand of discussion we've done quite a lot on this podcast, it always centres around West Ham, Newcastle and Spurs. This implication that they are the sort of club who would have their head turned by the 2, 3, 4 weeks of a major tournament and go, well, that guy's good. Whereas the big clubs wouldn't do that. I think that's actually quite a fair thing to assume.
I mean, I think in the mid... I see what you said about Spurs not being a big club there. I think in the mid-90s, that has happened though, right? I mean, Spurs in 1994 signed Klinsmann,
Romanians.
Yeah, Dumitrescu and Popescu off the back of the World Cup. Did West Ham sign Radicchio or someone off the back of Euro 96? Yeah,
they did.
And Newcastle,
I think it was the same World Cup.
Newcastle must have signed, so I don't know. That's very Newcastle, isn't it? I mean,
there was an influx of Senegalese talent after the 2002 World Cup, more recently.
It is amateur hour, isn't it? It is amateur hour, signing a player on the basis of a major tournament.
It can't happen anymore, surely.
No, it simply can't.
But there are, the only way it could is that if there are any clubs who have owners who might be, you know, more inclined to meddle in transfers, who are obviously not consulting their analysts and their data departments and say, I've seen him, he looked good. You know, David Gold ringing up and going, that Yarmolenko looks good. We should sign him.
Yes. Well, I mean, I do sympathise with the phenomenon, James, because there are some players who raise their games for international tournaments. They play out of their skin and they you know, literally put themselves in the shop window. So they're kind of misrepresenting themselves to get a move better than they perhaps would have done elsewhere. And the name that does leap out at me straight away is that of Kiefer Moore for Wales. If you'd never seen him play before and then you suddenly cast eyes on him in that opening game against Switzerland, you think he was a world beater. So it's not beyond the realms of possibility that whilst we're having this debate about sort of unproven Europeans going to mid-table European Premier League clubs, I can see Kiefer Moore going to someone like, I don't know, Galatasaray scoring 25 goals and we just be going, this is great, I'm really proud of him. But he's there's something slightly Giroud-esque about him. He could be the Welsh Giroud.
is this the kind of Gary Breen effect? Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. Thank you.
I feel like that is a thing that you kind of... We always go back to Gary Breen, and is that because it just hasn't actually ever happened with like a kind of player from like sort of one of the British teams or Ireland or wherever? I can't really think that's such a romantic idea. I mean, it'd be amazing to see something like that happen. Now you've said that, I really want that to happen. Sounds pretty much perfect. He definitely would get 25 goals there as well. He'd score, you know, in a Champions League against like Real Madrid or something as well.
So as the tournament unfolds, we may find more of these. We may return to this theme. Dave, get back to your wall chart. I hope your wall chart continues to flourish despite its rocky start.
I've taken great care with the games on Sunday. So
thanks for joining me. Thanks to you also, James, for racing back home to get your microphone for this. That shows real dedication.
My pleasure.
And... I hope everyone enjoyed this first Clichés episode of the Euros. We'll see you again in a few days' time.
The Athletic.